ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
And this is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day, welcome to the program. My name's Fiona Broom, filling in for Matt Brann for the next couple of days. Hope you are having a lovely Monday lunchtime. An unprecedented number of illegal foreign fishing vessels have turned up in northern waters over the past year. But how serious is that situation?
We've seen an increase in illegal fishing in our northern waters. So that's increased to levels that we haven't seen for about 20 years. And that's primarily Indonesian fishers coming down and targeting sea cucumber in our northern waters.
The worst it's been in 20 years. Fisheries authorities say the number of illegal fishing boats has more than tripled in the past year alone. Ahead on the show, you'll hear how Indigenous rangers think that problem could be tackled. You'll hear what's happening at the beginning of the pipeline, at the source of the problem. And ahead on the show, who's been crowned the Australian Working Cattle Dog Trials Champ? You'll find out over the next hour. Let's get into it. And as always, if you miss any part of today's show, you can catch up via the ABC Listen app. You can catch up anywhere that you listen to your podcasts. Just search NT Country Hour. But let's begin today on the sea borders. More than 230 foreign fishers have been prosecuted in the Darwin local court in the past 12 months. That's up from 75 prosecutions the year prior and up from 36 prosecutions in 2022 to 23. That's according to the Australian Fisheries Management Authority. Stefina Sully is the executive officer at the Dimaru Aboriginal Corporation, and she says the number of boats coming into northern waters has rangers and communities deeply concerned.
So we manage 550,000 hectares of land and sea. Each ranger manages equivalent up to 42,000 hectares per ranger, and that 42,000 hectares is equivalent to the size of the urban setting of Singapore. We have extensive marine life here, so we have tripang, we also have like different species of fish, and we have an abundance of it. Because we're situated in the Arafura Sea, close to the Timor Sea, which is close to Indonesia, East Timor, Papua New Guinea, we find that a lot of those countries are coming into our waters to predominantly fish. And so we've seen a scaling up of that illegal fishers coming through the north. I think it started in WA and has worked its way through. I think Maningrida and Tiwi Islands have had the exact same issues, and we've seen it just recently here last year, just before Christmas. A traditional owner came in with reports, thanks to the community, of seeing illegal fishers or vessels up near the Wessels.
Was that alarming to know that it's come so close to home, I suppose?
To know that it was only up here near the Wessels, which is managed by Martha Cull Rangers, was really, really disturbing because it's not far from us within our IPA. I've been in the Northern Territory for 15 years, and I've been here in Normanboy for 7 of those 15, and I have not really heard much of illegal fishing coming into the Northern Territory waters, like, you know, the north, but just in the last year, it has been non-stop reports, you know, and I know WA, like in the Kimberleys, they're seeing more and more fishing vessels entering through that side of the water, so it's definitely becoming an increase. I know in the Torres Straits it's always been an issue coming through because of the crayfishing there and the sustainability there as well.
When you're talking about having a ranger that covers a, you know, an area the size of Singapore, mm-hmm. For the land that they have to manage, how difficult is this issue to get on top of?
Very difficult. And we work really closely with Australian Border Force here. We have a really great relationship. Unfortunately, they're very low-resourced as well, just like us. So we try and work hand-in-hand together to combat this issue. But It is a massive problem. Rangers are there to manage land and sea on behalf of traditional owners and for their people. And that in itself is a massive role. And then on top of it now, we're having to do border security, which is very difficult because most of the time we're not out on the waters of night, you know, at night. We work Monday to Friday and, you know, rangers to manage country have to go out for weeks on end away from their family. So it's a massive toll.
Is that fair for them to have been put in the situation of having to be essentially border security?
No, not really. I think they do it, I know, you know, I think we do it because we do it for protection of land and sea because it is important as part of our culture. Who we are as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people really depends on country. And, you know, like I always explain to people, salt water and fresh water is like the blood that runs through our veins and it pumps the organs, the country. So we need that. We need to protect it. But, yeah, it is a massive, massive role and it is really difficult. And the rangers, however, are willing to take on that obligation, are willing to take on that responsibility because protecting country means more than anything else.
Should they, do you believe, be given more powers to deal with this and what kind of powers would you like to see them?
Oh, it'd be nice to have the rangers have a bit of compliance, you know, a bit of powers to actually enact and reinforce some of the laws here within these waters and within the land. It's also difficult too because we're also putting our own people at risk. There has been reports that I've heard about illegal fishers coming in with weapons and you don't want to put your family at risk or in danger of that. So it'd be good to be able to work a little bit closer with these bodies such as Customs and ABF and, you know, Navy, Army, whoever does these kind of patrollings and are supposed to be border security, to better understand the role that rangers play. I mean, they know the water. They know this country better than anyone.
You would like to see some more kind of border force powers to rangers? How could that work, do you believe?
I know that Australian Border Force have their funding that comes through and rangers, we have our funding. But we talk about capacity building and upskilling of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. For rangers here, I would love to see a Dimaru ranger become Australian Border Force officer, being able to train under that banner. And how powerful would it be to wear this logo, Dimaru, which means a lot to us, as well as an Australian Border Force logo on the same shirt? You know, it's not a separation of powers, but if anything, it's a collectiveness of powers together.
What is the worst case scenario should this keep going to the trajectory that it's going?
Worst case scenario is we're going to see a lot more boats entering the water. We're going to see a lot of our marine life and ecosystem damaged. It's going to be very difficult for us here. And I can't speak on behalf of Yolngu people, but I know Yolngu families here depend heavily on the ocean. It's a bush supermarket. It's their food. And if we don't have that, we don't have our supermarket. So having more and more vessels come in, taking away and damaging our fishing sustainability is, yeah, it's detrimental.
That's Stefina Sully, the executive officer at the Dimaru Aboriginal Corporation, speaking with Matt Garrick. There is more on that story online if you head to abc.net.au/news. In a statement, Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke did not directly answer questions about whether additional powers for rangers would be considered by the federal government. He did say that he was always looking for opportunities to strengthen the vital relationship between Indigenous rangers and the government. So that's what's happening on the ground here in the Northern Territory when it comes to illegal foreign fishing vessels in northern waters. But what's happening in Asia? I spoke with George Day from the Fisheries and Aquaculture branch of the Federal Department of Agriculture and Fisheries about some new programs that are aiming to tackle the problem of illegal fishing at the source.
The program is called the Combating IEU Fishing and Promoting Sustainable Fisheries in Southeast Asia program, and that's targeting illegal, unregulated and unreported fishing. and it aims to improve regional compliance against illegal fishing, strengthen cooperation, and also promote gender inclusivity in fisheries.
How serious is the issue of illegal fishing and unregulated fishing in Southeast Asia?
Globally, it's very hard to estimate the scope of the problem and the size of the problem, but we think it's quite significant. And there's estimates around of one in five fish taken globally is taken illegally or unregulated or unreported. So it's a significant issue, and we want to take an active role in the region to try and combat that problem.
What are the impacts of illegal and unregulated fishing? Is it concerns around economic impacts, or is it concerns about the fisheries and the environment?
The primary concern is around the impact on sustainability. So if people are fishing outside of rules, they're not fishing sustainably. So that's going to impact on the stocks. That has flow-on effects to economic impacts within the region. So fisheries are incredibly important for livelihoods in the region. So that impact on fish stocks is going to impact on communities that rely on fisheries. And then from an Australian point of view, we've got operators that are complying with the rules and they want to make sure they're competing on a level playing field.
Yeah, so fish don't have borders. So is something that's happening in the waters around Southeast Asia having an impact on fisheries and stocks in Australia?
That's right. So the fish don't recognise lines on the water. So if we want to have an effective response to illegal fishing, it needs to be a regional response, and the fish will transit between different countries' fishing areas and then onto the high seas as well. So we want to make sure that there's a comprehensive response across the region so it's as effective as it can be.
And what does that response look like? What are you hoping can be achieved with some of this work with partners in Southeast Asia?
So the program we're running at the moment, the Combating IUU Fishing and Promoting Sustainable Fisheries program, has four parts to it. And these were developed after consultation with partner countries in the region. And through the program, we're delivering training courses for officers across the region, where we run targeted capacity building support for countries. So working on things like monitoring of fishing vessels to understand where boats are fishing and to make sure they're fishing in the right spots. And then also skills around taking port state measures, which is preventing illegal fishing boats using ports to unload catch. And we've got the regional officer exchange, which has just taken place in Thailand, and that's hosting officers from around the regions to share information.
Are there particular fisheries that are impacted by illegal and unregulated fishing?
The fisheries impacted depends on the area. From an international perspective, the migratory species like tuna and billfish can be impacted by illegal fishing, and that impacts on countries that fish those stocks around the world. And then more locally, there can be more subsistence type fisheries that local communities rely on for food and for income. So that can be impacted by illegal fishing as well.
These problems that are present in Southeast Asia within the fishing industries, is some of that flowing into Australia? We have, over the past 12 months, been seeing what's been called an unprecedented number of illegal fishers turning up in Northern Territory waters. Is there a connection between what's happening here and what's happening in Southeast Asia?
We've seen an increase in illegal fishing in our northern waters. So that's increased to levels that we haven't seen for about 20 years. And that's primarily Indonesian fishers coming down and targeting sea cucumber in our northern waters. So that's certainly a regional issue that we're working on from multiple angles to try and reduce the occurrence of that and reduce the risk of that happening more in the future.
What work is being done in that space? Is some of that work connected with this project, or is that a different a project or scheme?
Yeah, we're approaching the problem from multiple angles. So on the water, obviously, is really important. So the operational response, and that's led by Australian Border Force operating along the northern coastline to detect and respond to illegal fishing. And they're supported by the Australian Fisheries Management Authority and engaging with local ranger groups to try and understand where the incursions are happening and then respond quickly to that. And we're seeing through that on the water response, prosecutions of illegal fishers in Australian courts, seizure of catch and fishing equipment, and also disposal of seized fishing vessels. Along with that, we're working with our Indonesian counterparts bilaterally through our embassy in Jakarta and then also in Canberra to improve bilateral relationships to understand the problems and the drivers for the problem. And there's been Australian agencies over in Indonesia running public information campaigns to explain the problem and the risks of illegally fishing. And then more generally, in addition to the Southeast Asia IEU program, we also work closely in the region through the Regional Plan of Action Against IEU Fishing. And that involves all Southeast Asian fishing countries and, again, is working towards a collaborative approach to targeting the problem, which is really necessary to address it. And finally, Australia is a member of regional fisheries management organisations, both in the Pacific Ocean and in the Indian Ocean, and we use those forums to take action against illegal fishing vessels. So we'll list illegal boats that have been doing the wrong thing, and that restricts their activity. So there's a real disincentive to fish illegally if they're going to be listed in these international forums.
There have been some fishers who've turned up in the Darwin courts charged with illegal fishing in the northern waters, repeat offenders, so people who've been caught on a boat, brought through the Darwin courts, sent home, and they've turned up here again. Does that show how complex it is to find a solution to this?
It does. I think it shows that there's a real drive pushing the fishers to do the wrong thing. So that's why we need to take that regional approach and really look at all the drivers for the illegal fishing as well as the response. And I'm sure the courts will take into consideration the fact that they're repeat offenders as well.
That's George Day. He's the Assistant Secretary of the Fisheries and Aquaculture Branch at the Australian Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry. 13 minutes to 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon, filling in for Matt Brown. He'll be back on your radio very shortly. I've got some resources news to share with you in just a moment. Do stick around. Boy and Bear there with Blood to Gold. A bit of a hint for you about the resources news I've got to share with you today. A new company is entering the Tanami gold space. The Perth-based company Mount Gibson Iron has agreed to buy Northern Star Resources' 50% stake in the Central Tanami Gold Project for $50 million. It's a shift from iron to gold for the company, whose last major iron ore mine at Koolan Island off the WA's Kimberley coast is set to wrap up at the end of next year. CEO Peter Kerr told Jess Baker what happens next to complete that acquisition.
So the acquisition price is $50 million, and for that we obtain Northern Star's half share in the Central Tanami Project joint venture. In addition, we also acquire some tenements, a large exploration land holding that Northern Star owns outside of the joint venture. So that's the package of assets there, and it gives us a very large land holding in the Central Tanami region. The conditions, or the key conditions to come, are we need Foreign Investment Review Board approval from the Treasury in Canberra, and we've made an application for that. Plus, there are other conditions relating to the existing joint venture party not exercising its first right of refusal, which we don't think it will do, and also other things that are fairly standard for agreements relating to tenure on the ground. So all of those conditions will take at least a few months to resolve.
Right. So when do you expect the project will be development ready, subject to those conditions?
I think the target in the first instance will be to try and complete the transaction, and we have up until early next year, so that's the end of March 2026, in which to satisfy the conditions. But if we can do it sooner, that would be much better. And then we would like to make a development decision on the project within 12 to 18 months. And that involves a range of work from drilling, engineering studies and permitting over that time. So the idea is if we could be in production within, say, two and a half years' time, that would be ideal.
And what kind of jobs could the project create if there's an 18-month timeline? I imagine there might be some jobs created in that time and then beyond when the project is up and running.
Yes, look, the specific numbers of jobs are going to be part of the work that we'll do within the joint venture shortly. But effectively, the works that are required are the refurbishment or construction of a gold processing plant. There is an old plant there, but it hasn't operated for 20 years. So it will need quite a bit of effort. Plus, there'll be work involved in infrastructure construction in a camp accommodation, haul roads, which are in existence but will need some effort. Plus, you add to that all of the mine development work that's required on a range of underground and open pit mines. So the actual personnel requirement will build fairly rapidly, even in the pre-production phase. And then, of course, after that, it would be a producing gold mine that would require personnel.
That's Mount Gibson Iron CEO Peter Kerr speaking there with Jess Baker about the company's recent acquisition, a proposed acquisition of a 50% stake in the Central Tanami Gold Project.
The Classic 100 Piano Highlights album is out now. Four CDs of Australia's favourite piano music. Get your copy at abc.net.au/classic/shop.
Hey, I'm Lynn Riss here from Tanami. I'm a safety advisor, but also the president of our amazing social club. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Six minutes to one here on The Country Hour. Fiona Broom with you this afternoon. Hope you are having a lovely Monday lunchtime. Well, it is Farm Safety Week all week. And a new real-time dashboard that tracks on-farm injuries and on-farm fatalities has been launched. The idea behind that is to keep everyone in industry updated on how and where dangerous incidents are occurring right across the country. This dashboard has been developed by Ag Health Australia. Kerry Lynn Peachy from the research team there says information can help to improve safety.
So the dashboard is an opportunity to provide some real-time insight into the types of incidents that are occurring on farms across Australia so that we can sort of raise that awareness of what risks are happening on the farms.
And so why was this needed?
Look, it was just that opportunity to provide information quickly because unfortunately it takes us a long time to be able to get the data that we are required to provide sort of analysts of what is occurring, so what agents are causing those injuries on farms or deaths on farms. So it was just giving that early insight into what actually is happening.
And was this also needed because incidents of on-farm accidents and fatalities is also quite high at the moment?
Look, yes, year by year. Unfortunately, we did have a very high number of fatalities last year, but this year we are sort of tracking a lot better. So we are going to see those trends move up and move down. That's just how things seem to happen, unfortunately.
Is it available to anyone to go and have a look at this dashboard?
Yeah, look, it's available for anybody to jump on and have a look at the dashboard. We have information there back to 2020, so that allows people to look at what's happened over time. And like you mightn't see something that we've done by industry. So, for example, in the cattle industry, there may have not been some deaths or injuries this year, but yet last year there may have been. So it allows users to look year by year to see what's occurring.
So if a user jumps on and has a look at the dashboard, what will they essentially be seeing?
So as they go in, there's an overview of what's in the dashboard. So you'll give, we look at quad bikes, we look at side-by-sides, we look at children on farm, we look at older farmers as well, but you get the overall numbers of injuries and fatalities across Australia.
So this dashboard is obviously showing what has happened previously and being used for, education, awareness, media reports. But do you think essentially it can help in hopefully reducing those numbers of on-farm accidents as well?
Look, we do, because it gives especially farmers and farm managers that opportunity to jump on and have a look what's occurring in their sort of region, so that they can see, well, okay, well, look, last week, you know, there was an incident involving a tractor run over, for example. So we just want to think, well, okay, we need to talk about that in our environment. Do we think that that's going to happen on our farm? Yes, it possibly could. So we need to talk about it and raise awareness around it. So we're hoping that that tool will allow that awareness and people start talking about what they can do to make things safer on their farm.
And I guess as well, having a look at maybe different industries as well. So it might be dairy or what's happening with, you know, maybe the pork industry or something like that, if there's specific incidents relating to that, or they might go, well, there seems to be more injuries related to this. How can we fix that on our own property?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes, and unfortunately, we don't know in a lot of circumstances what actually industry the accident occurred in. But, you know, the thing is that what we've got there is, you know, provides a bit of an overview for different industries like grains, like pork, like beef and dairy, for example. Look, I just like to acknowledge that, you know, while we don't capture all the injuries, mostly things are serious injuries that sort of require hospitalisation, but we are pretty confident that the fatalities that we record in the dashboard are just about on par of what we're seeing.
And where is the information coming from that is being put into the dashboard? Is it stuff that has to be reported?
Yes, so anything that's been reported in media reports, so whether it be social media, printed media, on the internet or radio news, that's how we pick up the reports.
That's Kerry Lynn Peachy from the Ag Health Research Team. She's also a broadacre farmer. She was speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. It is National Farm Safety Week all week. I'm sure you will be hearing plenty about that on the radio. There'll be plenty online on the socials. I'm just having a look at that dashboard. You do have to do a quick little registration and then click through a few buttons to prove that you're a human to then come through to that farm injury dashboard report. I've clicked through to Top Factors 2025. It is looking at role on farm, the role in the event, the age category. So a whole bunch of information in there if you are interested to know more. We are coming up to 1 o'clock. It will be news time very, very shortly. I'll be back with you at 1:05 to have a chat with the Weather Bureau. If you've got a question for the Bureau, you can send me a text 0487 99 1057. I'll see you back here in about 5 minutes' time.
G'day, this is Rowan Fisher from Charles Darwin University and North Australia Fire Information, NAFI. I'm sure most of you use it. It's the website that provides all the information for fire management across 80% of Australia. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
You are indeed listening to The Country Hour. Fiona Broom with you this afternoon. Hope you are having a lovely Monday lunchtime. Now, just before 1:30, I'm going to bring you the results from the Catherine Show Fetus Deer Sale. I've also got some results from the Crosscut Saw Championship for you. We're going to check in on the Working Dog Champions. It's all happening this half hour on The Country Hour. We'll also dip in and find out what the hot topics were at the Agri Hub at Catherine on the weekend. Let's check in now with the weather, find out what is happening across the Northern Territory. Kaya Impeshle is with us this afternoon. G'day, Kaya.
G'day, Fiona.
What is happening across the Northern Territory? We've got quite a few things happening this week, some clouds, some gusts, some potential rain.
Yeah, let's, I guess, first of all, talk about some gusty conditions. So we do have a weak cloud band basically in the southwest around Uluru area, and we could see those wind gusts. Basically, a trough is coming through, and it's quite strong. So far, we've seen some midday wind gusts at around 50 kilometres per hour at Yulara. We could see the winds themselves, the more average winds, in the afternoon here get up to 50 kilometres per hour, and perhaps that gust will increase to 60 kilometres per hour. And then as that trough moves sort of to the east, could get a bit gustier into the central Australia there around Alice Springs, so it could get a little bit gusty overnight in Alice Springs, and then that trough will move on. But actually, through those southern districts, a second trough will come through later in the week. And so, again, we could get those stronger winds, those, you know, 40 to 50 kilometre per hour winds in the southwest on Thursday. And then also Thursday night into Friday morning, the good chance of a shower through the Lassiter and Simpson districts. And in terms of the rainfall, basically looking at around 5 to 15 millimetres across the south there as that second cloud band moves through there.
So that rainfall total revised down a little bit from what we thought possibly we were going to get?
Yeah, that's right. The earlier modelling was indicating there could be some higher totals in there, but they've kind of those values have come down now. So, you know, even if someone's thinking about, for example, rain on the rock, which I hear is 20 millimetres. I heard that from Matt.
That's right. That's Stuart Brash in Alice Springs. That's his take. I think he said it's got to be 25 mil to get some of those waterfalls happening.
Yeah, I think I don't think that's likely. I think it'll be 15 millimetres over those 2 days is probably the best a place we'll get.
Rightio. Any rain expected any further north?
Yes. The answer is maybe in
maybe.
The sense of... Yeah, as that trough moves through later this week, it does get more humid in the top end. So from around Thursday into the weekend, the humidity will be increasing in the top end. You know, for people who know about things like a dew point, those dew point temperatures, particularly on the Friday in the Darwin area and along the coastal areas of the north, they will be getting above 20 degrees. So,
Yeah,
even during the day. So pretty humid there. And again, it's above 20 degrees during the day. So that'll be quite humid. And actually on the Friday and the Saturday, you will see a slight chance of a shower across the top end. Medium actually in the eastern parts of the top end, but on the western part, more like a slight chance, like a 20 to 30% chance of a shower there, which is notable for the Darwin show on Friday as well.
What's driving that humidity and that potential rain coming in?
Yeah, just as that second trough comes through late this week, the winds in the top end, they turn from easterly to northeasterly, so that sort of east-northeast, and that just lets some more moisture come into the top end there.
So a bit of a spicy week ahead in weather for us, Kaya. And looking at the fire incident map and notifications from Bushfires NT, there is a fair bit of fire in the landscape. What can you see at the moment?
Yeah. I guess I can see, looking at the satellite, quite a bit of smoke in the Arnhem there. So it looks like there are a few fires out there. And in terms of the dew point or the relative humidity, again, quite low relative humidities through much of the top end there. And I guess just with those conditions staying as dry as they are, you know, that'll help that fire behaviour. Oh, not fire behaviour, but, you know, potential for fires. Until, again, when late week, when that humidity increases, that'll hopefully help just mitigate that fire behaviour.
Mm. I've just got a text in here from Paul with a notification about a fire. I will check on that one, Paul, before I share those details. But yes, certainly a few fires popping up around at the moment. As you say, Kaya, hopefully some of that fire risk coming down towards the end of the week with some moisture and some dew and humidity about. Anything else we need to know? Any warnings for the territory today, Kaya?
No warnings for the territory there. No worries.
Lovely. Thanks for your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
Kaya Mpershley there at the Bureau of Meteorology.
Hi, my name is Tom Kwayakafai. I'm working in Northern Territory in Country Farm, Mambulu Farm, and you're listening to Country Hour.
It's coming up on 12 minutes past one here on the Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. We're going to check in on some Catherine Show sale results and some very special competitions that happened there. I'll bring you that before 1:30. Some other comps happening around the country. The Australian Working Cattle Dog Trials Championships have been on. And a four-year-old border collie from Queensland has taken out the 2025 championship. The win topped off an incredible weekend for 25-year-old Luke Acethorpe and his team of dogs. And they've only been competing for a very few short years. On Saturday, Luke and his dog Jaffa won the Sire Shoot. The very next day, Jaffa's daughter Eva took home the National Opens title after a very exciting runoff. And Kim Honan was there and she caught up with Luke and the dogs.
Congratulations, you've taken out the Open here at the Australian Cattle Dog Championships.
Yep. Thank you.
And with your dog Eva?
Yes. Yep. Yep, Sticks Eva. So she's a four-year-old tri-coloured bitch that my dad actually bred. So her mother is Riverside Cindy, and then her father's Natal Jaffa. So yeah, her father won the Sire Shootout last night too. So yeah.
So you've had a pretty good weekend.
Yeah. I definitely can't complain. Yeah, it's been pretty good. Well worth the drive down. So.
Yeah. And how long did it take to get here?
Would have been about 8 hours, 8.5 hours. Probably a bit faster for some people, but I tend to do a bit of stuffing around while I'm driving. So,
yeah. And how many dogs did you bring?
I had 6 in the Open, 7 in the Novice and 4 in the Maiden. So, yeah, I had a few dogs for the weekend. So, yeah.
And to take out the Sire Shootout and the Australian Championships title, how does it make you feel?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Like, you're pretty happy just to do sort of well or make a final or be in the ribbons anywhere really, and yeah, it was pretty cool achievement to win two of them. So yeah,
and you take home an $11,000 check, the highest in the Australian titles history, I believe.
Yeah, it's really cool. I probably would have come down even if it was $100 prize money, but yeah, the prize money definitely makes it worthwhile.
And is this your first national titles?
The first time I've won the Open, yeah. I was lucky enough to win the Maiden last year at St. George. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. There's a fair few, names on the shield that are, pretty successful dog trialers, so it's pretty cool to be on there on that too.
And what does it take to, breed and train Australia's top working dog?
A fair bit of time, I suppose, and patience. Like, hasn't been the easiest dog to train, and she's got a few years of age on her now. She's sort of matured up a little bit more. Yeah, and I just think she's a good, practical dog, and she just was lucky enough that things went her way this weekend. So.
And to have to go back into the ring to fight it out with another competitor today?
Yeah, had a rerun. Which I think at these sorts of events isn't always uncommon, the competition's always pretty tight, so. But yeah, it's a bit nerve-wracking, but it's pretty good competition at the end, so.
So how long have you been trialling for?
I did my first trial in, I think, 2021 with Jaffa. He was about 14 months old, and that was at Wallumbilla.
So very young in your career to take out the national titles.
Yeah. I don't know who the youngest person would be. I think maybe Isaac Potts. He would have been fairly young. But yeah.
And were you in the State of Origin team?
Yeah. I was in the State of Origin team with Jaffa. Yeah. So we were pretty lucky that Queensland had a pretty good win there last night. So yeah, it's been a pretty good weekend all around.
So you've had the trifecta.
Yeah. So to a certain degree, I suppose. Yeah.
That's Luke Acethorpe from Monto in the Burnett region of Queensland. He's the 2025 Australian Working Cattle Dog Trials Champion. Can you believe that? His first trial was in 2021 with his dog Jaffa there. I think he said Jaffa was about 14 months old, and he's already the national champion. Just incredible. Congrats to Jaffa and Jaffa's daughter Eva. 16 minutes past one here on the Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. I've had a request for some old school Taylor Swift. Here she is. And our song. Our song from Taylor Swift there. Gosh, hasn't her sound changed over the years? It is show season, Darwin show coming up at the end of the week. I'm disproportionately excited about heading out to that show later in the week. The Catherine show just wrapped up. After its 60th year, there was plenty of entertainment on offer, cattle showing, lawnmower races, of course, the camp draft. You'll hear about the cross saw competition very shortly. Agriculture was, though, of course, at the heart of the show. Rabobank's senior rural manager, Barry Gershwitz, was there. He said there was plenty of juicy ag chat going on this year.
Yeah, we had a range of speakers here talking from the Rabo truck, which is a platform to deliver knowledge and share ideas, I suppose, out there amongst predominantly our clients, but also the broader industry and then also the urban or rural other communities out there. So we had speaking on, you know, youth opportunities in ag. We had cotton, representatives of Cotton Australia talk, NT government talk about some of the opportunities there as well. Update on live exports. So a whole range of topics we covered off there today.
And was there one topic that jumped out to you that you thought would be particularly interesting?
Well, for me personally, I think it was really exciting to see some of the younger ones and the opportunities in ag. I was also a young one, so I see the opportunities here in the north for young ones in particular, but there's huge opportunity, and some of the younger ones talk about that opportunity, and their passion for agriculture is really good.
Certainly cotton as a fodder crop is something that has very much grown in interest. Can you tell me about the opportunities or challenges ahead for that?
There's lots of opportunity. There's also opportunities, but there's also plenty of challenges. It is, I think we've got to remember, we're still very much in the pioneering days of cotton. We're not like an Emerald or those other places in Queensland, New South Wales that have been doing it for many years. We're still, you know, only in the relatively baby stages of this, so we've got a lot of learning to do as the cotton producers do. But I have absolute confidence we can get better at it. And I think the spin-offs from cotton is, a good thing. We just got to be patient with it and... Just try and get better at it, and I think we can, and as an industry we can, and you know, the gin here is important. Cotton seed is a really important byproduct for the north, and I think as people start to use that cotton seed in their feeding rations or supplementary type things, there's a lot of potential for it, for sure.
So I was at the cotton gin a few weeks back, and I was told that a lot of the cotton seed generally goes back to the farmer as a source of protein for fodder. Why is that here, I guess? What are you seeing?
One of the problems we have in the north is a protein drought, which we get every year. So, and cotton seeds quite high in protein. I think it's around about 20% protein. So, and it's been proven many years it's actually a very beneficial cattle feed, and even for the rumen and so forth, it's actually got some really positive effects on the cattle, on the digestive system and so forth. So used properly, and it's a great I think it's right on our doorstep now. In the past, it's been far too expensive because the freight is a killer. Well, now it's here as an opportunity for that, and I'm sure, that once people start using it a bit more and they see the results for themselves, I think we'll see more of it. And who knows where that may lead to. We could see more of a feed industry perhaps develop in the north in the future. Sadly for the guys down south, I feel for them with a drought, and it's been pretty tough for some of those people, but I guess their misfortune becomes a fortunate thing for some of the guys here. And I know there's significant amounts of hay moving down to even places like Victoria, which we don't normally see too much of that in a normal season. And I believe there's cotton seed, or certainly inquiry for cotton seed down there. They may put it into a ration and a mix, or even just cotton seed for drought fodder. Yes, there's certainly opportunity for that. I don't believe that will happen every year, but while it's there, we'll no doubt take advantage of it. And the other thing with it is you get, obviously, the cotton seed, but then there's got to be rotation crops as well. So, potentially, challenges with things like corn and sorghum and silage and all those kind of things all fit into a whole farming system. So it's not going to be just cotton farms. We're talking about a farming system, as is around most of the world, where people are a part of a rotation, and cattle and cotton and corn and, even hay crops and so forth and part of it. And it's not going to be for everybody, but it's certainly great to have another alternative. And the great thing with it is something you can forward project, you can lock in prices and so forth. It's a globally traded commodity, which makes it attractive as well.
That was Barry Gershwitz from Rabobank speaking with Christine Schindler at the Catherine Show. And for the third year at the show, Elders held an Indonesian feeder steer sale. I caught up with sales manager Peter Kelly to find out how the numbers went at that sale this year.
3 years ago, we decided Indonesia is our largest market for live export. So 3 years ago, we decided to bring in a special class that we held over at the Flanagan Yards for Indonesians, a pen of Indonesian show steers or bulls, pen of 15 from 280 to 380 kilos. It was to get the station staff involved. They go out there and see the agents and the exporters selecting different cattle, and it's to get the staff involved in putting together a nice line of steers to present at the show sale.
And how did they look at this year's show sale?
They were absolutely fantastic. Credit to everyone involved, all the stations that supported it. We had cattle from steers from Hayfield, Merrifield, Camfield, Killarney, Wave Hill. And it was really well supported and hoping to keep growing it.
So you had about 105 on offer?
That's it. Yeah, pens of 15. They were judged as they were trucked in. So this year was taken out by Hayfield Station with a magnificent line of Brahman steers, and Reserve Champion was taken out from by Wave Hill Station.
And how were the prices looking? What was the average price across that sale?
Average would have been the high 340s. So the top money in Darwin at the moment for big lines is between that 330 and 40. So we managed to get well above that market. We've got no freight from Katherine to Darwin. The freight was kindly donated that took all the steers up to Darwin. The top price from Hayfield made $3.55 for the Grand Champion pen, and the Reserve Champion pen was $3.50. And to be noted, all the cattle were purchased by Austrex with great support from the other exporters as well.
How is the season looking, and how's the market looking at the moment?
Yeah, no, it's been very good. A lot more consistency this year. We haven't had the big falls in the market like we have seen previously. I was over in Indonesia about a month ago, saw some beautiful Australian cattle over there, as well as Indonesian local cattle that were getting ready for the Corban Festival at the time.
We have been hearing that the meals programs that have been launched in Indonesia have also been driving real interest in Australian cattle. Is that what you're seeing and hearing?
Oh, a lot of it comes down to performance. Indonesians are very, very good at feedlotting Brahman cattle. They prefer, from Australia, they prefer Brahman cattle. A lot of local cattle over there derived from the old Dutch days of the Limousins and Simmentales, so there's still those local cattle over there, but performance-wise, they prefer the Brahmins from Australia. They're not chasing, insanely large ADGs. They're just bringing them up to weight consistently. Looking around that 1.5 kilos a day is a good average over there.
Now, you had another event at the Katherine Sale. You had your crosscut saw competition.
Yeah, that's crosscut saws. Great fun for everyone on the Friday afternoon. It's been a long tradition over 20 years at 3 o'clock. We had 18 teams from majority of various stations, plus a few local enthusiasts that got into it. And it's always a great crowd puller, and everyone has a great fun doing it. It's conducted over just on times. We had a couple of ladies' teams as well, and everyone has a great time, and it's enjoyable.
Who were the winners from this year's comp?
So this year, the winners were Ross Reynolds and Peter Harris. Ross actually won it last year when he was working on the station, one of the local stations here, but this year he's currently working for Elders.
Peter Kelly from Elders in Katherine there with the results from the Crossaw Championship at the Katherine Show. That is all the time we've got on the Country Hour today. I'm Fiona Broom. Great to have had your company this Monday lunchtime. If you missed anything from today's show, you can head online, search NT Country Hour to find the podcast, or you can listen back on the ABC Listen app. Keep it rural. Catch you later.